Welcome to the 1CA podcast. This is your host, Jack Gaines. 1CA is a product of the Civil Affairs Association and brings in people who are current or former military, diplomats, development officers, and field agents to discuss their experiences on ground with the partner nation's people and leadership. Our goal is to inspire anyone interested in working the last 3 feet of foreign relations. To contact the show, email us at capodcasting@gmail.com or look us up on the Civil Affairs Association website at www.civilaffairsassoc.org. I'll have those in the show notes.
Hi, everyone. I'm Mariah Yeager, your host for today's SMA speaker session titled On Persuasion. We have Bass Wouters, who is co-founder and CEO of the Cialdini Institute. He's the author of Online Influence, which is combining Dr. Cialdini's work with insights from other behavioral experts, creating a highly practical framework to boost online results.
Please welcome Mariah Yeager and Bass Wouters to 1CA Podcast. Originally, I was co-hosting the show with Mariah, but I got OBE'd, or overcome by events, so Mariah covered until I arrived to help with questions and answers. This is part two of a two-part series. Part one was last week. Check it out if you haven't heard it. But either way, enjoy.
And then something fun happens. When we start talking in these kinds of sessions, it's often a competition who has the loudest voice. We are all together in a room and you've all been there and only two or three people are continuously talking and the rest is pretty silent. That's not very productive because you don't get the best ideas in the room. You get the ideas from people with the loudest voice. You first need to do something else. You need to think. We often act on a question right away, pretty impulsive, but that doesn't mean that's the best idea you can come up with. We say, think 5 to 7 minutes, really crack your brain. That's not 30 seconds thinking and 4.5 minutes staring out the window. Really think. And after people did that, again, we don't want to have the competition who has the loudest voice. We want to hear everybody's ideas. So you want to have all ideas on the table. That's why we recommend give people 2 to 3 minutes max per person so they share not all their ideas, but the best ideas to overcome your challenge. Therefore, you're only collecting what people themselves support as their best ideas. And now, based on that, step one, one person is talking. Step two, everybody is silent in the room. Thinking is an individual process. Then step three, solicit input. Again, one person is talking. Don't react on the ideas of the other person. Don't say, that's a great idea, or yes, but I think this is better. Wait till step four, and then create an action plan. You do this process with 3 to 6 people. So in a time framing here, you have 5 minutes for step back. Let's say 7 minutes to think, that's 12 minutes. If you have 3 people, give them 3 minutes. That's 9 minutes in total, plus 12 is 21 minutes. Then you have 9 minutes to create an action plan. And then you do this entire process in only 30 minutes. How many brainstorm sessions we have for an hour and not walk away with an action plan? Applying this to influence will create you a solid action plan. Only what do we say, what kind of action plan we suggest is a list of bullet points. Prioritize your ideas that you're going to implement and make them from low-hanging fruit to the more complicated ideas to implement and start doing that. Don't write full reports because two things can happen. One, the person who's writing these reports anchors their brain. Oh, this is the solid truth now, and we cannot diverge anymore. An influence process needs to be flexible. And second, often in organizations, what research also tells us, people don't read these reports. So create an action plan, a list of bullet points, prioritize them in the order you're going to execute them. And then in 30 minutes, applying the influence process, you can get more effective outcomes in a more efficient time frame. Thank you all for your attention. And of course, we're going to answer questions.
All right. Thank you so much, Bass. That was great.
Welcome.
So Chris Voss' book, Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. you know, it's like, hey, there seems to be a lot of similarities between negotiating and persuasion. So I want to ask if you expand a little bit on this, the semantics, and also include the word influence. In your title, you say, like, you looked into the science of influence and persuasion. Can you talk about, like, what's the difference between influence, negotiating, persuasion?
Oh, I like that. So influence, there are many forms on how to influence another human being. Let's say money is a tool to influence people. If I have a request and I walk into the room with a suitcase with $1 million in it, and I say, well, if you say yes to my request now, you get these $1 million. Probably I increased my chances to hear a yes. Problem with money is, if I want to influence that person again, what will they ask? At least for $1 million or probably more. So money isn't a resource in influence that has ongoing power. Second, violence, force is a way to influence people. Entire regimes build on that principle. What happens if people are under pressure? You force them, they push them, people start pushing back. So again, we don't see that it has a great long-term effect. Works on the short run, but not on the long run. And then we have persuasion. Persuasion, how we perceive it, is influencing people with images and words so you can have a short-term win, but also on a long-term. That's how we see influence versus persuasion. So persuasion is a form of influence. If I connect it to negotiation, persuasion is used during negotiations. So you use persuasion to negotiate more effectively.
All right. Thank you for that.
Hi, Mariah. This is Jack Gaines.
Oh, hey, Jack.
Sorry for being late. I did want to thank Boss for coming in and covering for me. But also I wanted to address this question because in Chris's book, he talks about tactical empathy. And what that is the ability to, as you're engaging in persuasion, reaching into your audience's mindset and understanding their motivations, their practices and culture, what their projected behaviors will be, and then applying your negotiations towards that so that you're signaling to them that you hear them and you understand them. You don't have to empathize with them, but you have to signal that you understand where they're coming from in order to then bring them to the table and negotiate a settlement. And so I just wanted to bring that up because I think that's a key part of the persuasion process.
That makes total sense. And that also has to do with that early model that I introduced, the sender-receiver model. Of course, you have to know who is your audience. And that's what I connected with the core motive. What kind of signals do you get? Why people don't move in your direction? So I see there also the connection with the work of Chris Voss, which is brilliant, by the way.
I agree. Okay, I'm going to go back to mute. Please continue, Mariah. Sorry.
No. Hey, Jack, glad you were able to join us. For the audience, Jack Gaines was going to help with the session. Unfortunately, was called away. But no, Jack, glad to have you and jump in if you'd like. With that, I'm going to go to our next question. What SMA speaker series would we have if we didn't bring in some kind of philosopher? So Aristotle, his three pillars of persuasion, ethos, pathos, logos, formulated over 2,400 years ago, and it's largely been validated through scientific studies in the 20th century. So how do the seven principles you laid out compare to Aristotle's?
I'm thinking out loud how we compare. Well, what my answer would be is, and it's interesting that somebody brings it up, that it works throughout time. Yes, there is comparison with Aristotle's and the seven principles. What you see actually, and what's for me the biggest takeaway, is that it is tested by the power of time. Human behavior and decision-making, and therefore how to be more influential, doesn't change. From Daniel Kahneman, who called it System 1, System 2, how do we make decisions? That's deeply rooted in our system. So I would answer that question, how is it connected? That it's connecting about persuasion doesn't change a lot. This material was powerful 2,000 years ago. It still is today.
No, absolutely. All right, thank you. How do we take these principles and the process from the one-to-one to the one-to-many or the company-to-company or government-to-government?
Like that. So one-to-many, that's, of course, a form of communication that came up with the internet. So there's definitely a difference in persuasion going on with online persuasion, because nonverbal communication is very powerful in influence situation. But if you communicate to a mass email or to a website or a web page, you don't have the luxury of using nonverbal cues, and you don't have the luxury of anticipating on your audience. So there's already a difference, which you have to realize. So you have to design more in a way how those elements communicate nowadays. Then the question, how do you do this more from organization to organization? A lot of time I get the question, is this applicable for B2B? Yes, it is, because there are human beings in those organizations still making decisions. At the moment, AI bots or robots will take over the decision making, then we have a different world. But at this moment, yes, human beings make the decision. So yes, it's applicable in those situations. And even there's multiple research studies that shows that reciprocity, for example, is not only applicable to individuals, it's also applicable to organizations and even in entire countries. To give you an example, which is Dutch and American, so maybe now I briefly introduce that. When Hurricane Katrina hit the U.S., of course, there was a lot of damage. Very early on, there was a politician that took the stage and said, well, we are so happy that we already sent a lot of help to New Orleans to help all these people. While in reality, about 85% of all the people didn't receive help yet. So why is this politician claiming that he's so proud? It was actually a Dutch politician that made that claim. And the Dutch government actually acted almost quicker than the US government to support. Why? In 1953, we had a water flood disaster, and that 50% of our nation was entirely underwater. Who helped us? The Americans from New Orleans. That happened in 1953. If I'm not mistaken, Hurricane Katrina was in 2007. So the people who made the decision in the Netherlands to right away help people were those the people that actually had the help in 1953. No, they were children if they were even born. But still, there was a pressure to pay back the people of New Orleans, because the pressure of acting reciprocal was not even on the individuals. It was on an entire society. So yes, so these principles will transcend that it's just based on individuals.
Thank you for that. So what are some examples of the methods that you have used to assess the effects of influence when it's not sales focused? And is there a challenge when it takes time to assess the effects?
Yes, in an early assessment or in research, there's always a challenge to get significant data so you can make a certain claim. Scientific approved research, of course. How do you assess this? Based on outcomes. I just heard the word negotiation. In this case, there was negotiation about one Fortune 100 company want to buy other companies. What was being assessed? Changing a few small elements in the approach of the negotiation led that an average merchant acquisition process went down from 9 months to 6 months. How could they do it? By not measuring one merchant acquisition process, but multiple, and still only change that small item. So that's one. Another thing, what Dr. Cialdini, for example, and Dr. Neidert advised is how to gain information. There's an example in the book Persuasion from Dr. Cialdini, so I can talk about that. He refers to a behavioral scientist who helped in negotiating terrorists to get information. And he didn't give any information at all. They found out he was a diabetic, and they gave him sugar-free cookies and tea instead of having all these other approaches that were common. And within a very short amount of time, he opened up and started talking. Of course, that's based on the principle of reciprocity. So how do you measure it? It's about setting your goal and reach if that goal is achieved more often. That's the key focus, and then act percentages. So as you also understand, we have also a lot of real life challenges where we consult. It's not the scientific research that we apply. It's applying the research to real life cases. And then it's very easy. Did we get an increase in the current result, or did we realize the goal in general? So for example, in the last case, it was the goal. Does this person start stalking? Yes, he did. So the influence strategy worked. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, it was. And actually, it's got me thinking about more about measurement effects. So in your experience, what about success measured in a behavior not happening or decision not happening? What examples or lessons have you learned in your experiences there?
In a way of measuring it or changing it?
To be honest, both. Specifically, I was asking about the measurement of it. Because there's a lot of people in our audience that's going to be part of their job. Is like, how do we know that we were successful and be able to show that?
Boss?
Yeah.
So I've got an example.
I came up with one, but please feel free to add an example.
Okay. This is Jack Gaines again. Back when I was at UCOM, we were working with the Ukraine Air Force on air corridor security. And one of the problems at that time, back in 2011, 2012, was that the Russians were having fits over the European Ballistic Missile Defense Program, troops going into Poland and setting up a preliminary base. And so we were trying to figure out, how do we run these air corridor exercises without building more rancor with the Russians? And what we decided was that the European soccer championships were coming up in about 6 to 8 months. And so we tied the air security corridor to helping protect the European soccer championships from another 9/11 style attack. And then we also brought in that Sochi was coming up and that this is typical for major sporting events, so that it then forced Russia to accept that this was not an attack on them, but helping to support a larger event. And so with that mindset, they just did not message. They were all over ballistic missile defense. They're all over the troops in Poland, but they withdrew from messaging on Ukraine. It created a positive environment to where they had no place to message without looking bad.
I love this example. That leads also to what I want to introduce as a word. It's often also be creative in these situations, like you currently have. Look at the whole picture. Where can you connect certain things, or how can you work around things when you aren't able to get the information? An example I wanted to introduce is research done by Dr. Cialdini based on, can you predict the outcome of an election even more closely than the polls are doing? And in fact, that was the case. He did that in multiple states. And what he did was, when people voted, he put flyers on their bicycles, their cars, whatever they came with. And of course, there were flyers from the two candidates. And they calculated. So you just voted for a certain person, you don't put the flyer on the ground. That was the assumption, the hypothesis. If you just not voted for that person, but his competitor, you probably would put that flyer on the ground. So by counting the flyers, he could predict the outcome in that certain state more closely than even the exit polls were doing it. So it's about also being creative. And what I said about Dr. Cialdini, he is known to be a great observer and known to set up these workarounds with what you can have and come up with those solutions.
So influence and persuasion are mentioned a lot as we look at competition in the South China Sea between the U.S. and China. And I think this could be applied to not only this example, but other examples. So how can or should the U.S. government use these principles of persuasion and the influence process in competition?
I like to answer questions based on case study, of course. So you are in competition with China to reach a certain goal. So again, Where do you have the leverage of these principles? What is going on? By knowing these activators and amplifiers of these principles, knowing a case, then you can win the competition. I think in every influence challenge, you are in a certain competition. It's about being the detective using these principles in the most efficient and effective way. It's knowing the situation and then be able to look through these principles, what is your most persuasive approach? So to answer that question, I'm happy to give a more detailed answer because I understand this is pretty vague, but I like to get some more in-depth question about a certain case where I can say, well, in this case, this principle would be great. America is still perceived as the world economy. So there's an expert level, there's authority in certain cases. You have the expert on that certain matter. Again, I need to know who are you persuading? What are you trying to achieve? What is China trying to achieve? To give you a good informative answer on this challenge.
You want me to jump in?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. One issue that's a great example is Cleo Pascal, who covers the PRC's influence on Palau and the Marshall Islands. Her concern is that the PRC comes into a nation like Palau or the Marshalls, and they use criminality or direct influence to buy elections and then use those elections to change how the policy in that nation is towards PRC or removing recognition of Taiwan and other things. And usually the way that she spots it is that the PRC either tries to do a free trade zone within Palau in order to run a casino, run drugs, run money into the nation and then start buying influence in the political realm to get their foreign policy goals. This is also very similar to what Sam Cooper talks about. He just recently went to the Canadian Foreign Influence Commission and spoke about how China is using drugs and casinos to run drugs in and spread throughout the population, gain money, launder it back through the casinos, but also then buy properties in Canada as long-term holds for their financial assets. But then they use that money and position to influence politicians to get either reduced political scrutiny on their actions, or they do direct buys to bring influence on that country to support more PRC foreign policy goals. And so by knowing their behaviors and actions, then you can start to expose certain aspects of it. And that's what Cleo did in Palau. She exposed the free trade zone and some of the rules that are being applied, but by exposing it, forced the politicians then to acquiesce that it was a bad deal, and then they shut it down. And so they did build a casino in the country. They still continue influence, but she continues to dog them on what they're doing as they try to persuade that country to remove their ties with Taiwan and build more ties with PRC. And so exposure and countering with better options, as well as showing the criminal intent that's going on, all the negative things that a competitor is doing, you expose. The good things they're doing, you can steal. And then you also then build your counter brand to compete with them. So you offer better trade and security deals. Like I said, you steal their good things and use them for yours as well. So you outcompete in that space. And then you try to build the whole brand on top of that, where you're offering things that the PRC just cannot do because of the structure of their government. So there's my example in Palau and the Marshalls of what's going on that support this. Hopefully that helps.
Thanks. Helps a lot, Jack.
Thanks, boss.
It shows for me two things of the influence process. You see the long-term influence action plan there. A lot of people associate influence with a quick interference, but it's often built on multiple mini influence challenges to reach the next step in your end goal. So there are multiple micro challenges, so to say, to reach your end goal. So I think that's very important to realize. It's not one intervention often and have these huge influence challenges solved. You have to break it down into a step-by-step action plan. The second thing, for what I hear, by exposing them, they lose their credibility. If you lose your credibility, you lose your ability to use the principle of authority. So this is indeed a counterattack where the principles are actually used against the other person in order to make you more credible. And again, you're talking about one of the seven principles.
Misinformation and disinformation. I mean, this is a ubiquitous problem. So based on your experience, principles, your influence process, specifically, how can the U.S. best counter misinfo and disinformation?
Very interesting challenge we are dealing with. You have a lot of trolls, especially social media. If you watch, for example, the Great Hack documentary, you see the huge impact of this misinformation can lead to complete genocides in some African countries who were triggered just by messaging on Facebook. So yeah, it's something very important we have to deal with. But the initial advice here is, it's often built on social proof. A lot of these trolls claiming something. So the best counterattack on those messages is the authority message. Show the experts are not agree with the majority here. So that's the best. You have to counter those messages with a more credible message. So that's the 30-second answer. And of course, there's a lot going on. But this is definitely, make sure you are perceived as the expert, as the trustworthy, credible sender. So your message will override the message of those many fake information that is out there.
No, absolutely. Honestly, another thing that was talking about, a new challenge is AI, you know, machine learning and what that's changing the landscape.
Especially in influence, I like to say quickly a word. The danger there is that people perceive what, let's say, ChatGPT, an AI bot, tells them as 100% truth nowadays. With social media posts from others, we are still slightly skeptical. When we see it a lot, of course, there's social proof, and it moves us more into that message. But AI, if you control what is the outcome of AI, people perceive it almost without thinking as the truth. So there's, again, indeed, interesting challenges coming up that needs to be addressed as well. You're mute, Mariah.
This is not my first day, guys. All right. I was just saying with that, or we're a little bit over the hour. I want to thank our audience for joining us today and sending us questions. Bas, thank you so much for your time and presenting all this information. It was great for me. I was telling you earlier, I'm a communication grad. And one of the reasons I added on communication as the second major is because I could walk out of the classroom and apply it. And you said that right at the top, and see that to this day. So I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you for listening in.
Absolutely. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you get a chance, please like and subscribe and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. Also, if you're interested in coming on the show or hosting an episode, email us at capodcasting@gmail.com. I'll have the email and CA Association website in the show notes. And now, most importantly, to those currently out in the field, working with a partner nation's people or leadership to forward U.S. relations, thank you all for what you're doing. This is Jack, your host. Stay tuned for more great episodes, 1CA Podcast.